Good evening, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to all of you here. It's so wonderful to see so many people here in person. Welcome to all of you online joining us virtually. I'm Rabbi Lori Kaufman, Director of Content and Innovation here at Park Avenue Synagogue, and we're so excited for this evening's discussion. We know it's just going to be wonderful. The Torah portion this week and next week deal with rashes, eruptions on skin, on clothes, in buildings. And the rabbis ask, what causes these eruptions? And they answer based on a classic midrashic rabbinic pun. So the eruptions are called mitzora, and the rabbis say it's caused by motzi shem ra. What is motzi shem ra? Using your words badly, telling lies, slander, gossip, using words to tear down. Why is that so bad? Because in our tradition, words are holy. Baruch she'amar v'haya olam, God spoke and the world was created. Words are used to create, to inspire, to make change. Words are wondrous. Words are our stock and trade. We are people words are our currency, which is why we are so excited to be partnering with Sapir Journal. Sapir is a new journal published by the Maimonides Fund that offers ideas for building thriving Jewish future. Sapir's articles address the American Jewish community, its relationship with Israel, and its interaction with larger trends in contemporary American politics and culture. Led by Editor-in-Chief Brett Stevens, Sapir features thought-provoking authors, like our own Rabbi Cosgrove, who are not afraid to say controversial things and to run counter to prevailing narratives in Jewish communal life. Each volume focuses on a particular theme. Thus far, issues have tackled social justice, power, continuity, aspiration, and Zionism. But Sapir is not just about ideas. It's also about action. The articles aim to be solutions-oriented, marrying analysis to concrete prescriptions and policies in a way that's timely, challenging, and provocative. We have the beautiful volumes here, and you can also find it online at sapirjournal.org. And tonight is the first of, as I just said, a partnership that Park Avenue Synagogue is forming with Sapir. We will have two more programs, one in April in honor of Yom HaShoah with Ruth Weiss and Dara Horn, Sapir contributors. And one on May 3rd, in honor of Yom Ha'atzma'ut, we welcome Blake Flayton and Carly Unell to discuss the challenges of being a supporter of Israel for young adults and on college campuses. And now I'm going to introduce Brett Stevens, who really doesn't need an introduction, but I'll do it anyhow. Brett Stevens is the editor-in-chief of Sapir, an op-ed columnist at the New York Times. He was previously at the Wall Street Journal, where he served as deputy editorial page editor and, for 11 years, a foreign affairs columnist. Before that, he was editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. And we want to thank all the folks at Sapir and Maimonides Fund for a wonderful partnership, especially Mark Cherendorf, Felicia Herman, and Ariella Saperstein. And now over to you.
Thank you, Rabbi Kaufman. And thank you to everyone who is here. It's wonderful to see everyone here and to be seen by everyone online. Welcome. It is such, you know, I'm filled with joy because the last time you were here was pre-COVID, Brett, and now to be back on the Bima with you, it's terrific. I know we have a lot to dive into, and you're going to ask me questions. I'm going to ask you questions. The community's going to ask both of us questions. But I want to build on Rabbi Kaufman's gracious introduction and introduction to the partnership. Brett, you don't lack for things to do in this world. So what drew you to the mission of Sapir, and what role do you see Sapir playing in the discourse of American Jewry?
Well, first of all, Rabbi, thank you for having me back in this beautiful sanctuary. And thanks for writing, I think, one of the most revelatory pieces in the third of our issues, continuity. I was a little bit myself starved for Jewish content. That's, I think, the first answer to your question. I spent a lot of my life thinking about domestic policy issues, foreign policy issues. It's a lot of fun to cover these subjects. From time to time, I write about Israel in my job as an op-ed columnist at the New York Times. But the Jewish side of my life is a big side of my life, and particularly in its more, I guess, the intellectual side. And so the publishers of, or I should say the head of the Maimonides Fund came to me at the beginning of 2021, maybe end of 2020, with the suggestion of putting together one issue of essays that would discuss concerns, you know, a kind of a collection of essays addressing concerns in Jewish life. And I said, you know, if we do one issue, it's not going to have the impact that we desire. There's just such a torrent of material that people are expected to read. Why don't we do four? Why don't we do them thematically, as Rabbi Kaufman just said, the first one on social justice, then on power, then on continuity, then on aspiration. Let's make a point of doing something that other publications, or I should say too few publications do, which is to draw on voices with whom we don't agree. Voices to the right of me, voices to the left, secular, religious, have a real journal of Jewish conversations, and conversations about what? Conversations about how to create a thriving Jewish future. That is what we conceive as our mission, ideas for a thriving Jewish future. So I think the best way to do that is to do what Jews do well. We speak, and sometimes we argue, and we bring different voices together in a kind of an iterative way, so that some people might come up with ideas of their own. This is an effort to create sparks in Jewish minds. The other thing that I urged Maimonides to do was to publish no more than 5,000 copies. So, you know, if we're going beyond 5,000 people, we're failing, which is not the usual model of thinking of a publication. I'm not interested in really reaching the widest possible audience, but I am interested in reaching an audience that is deeply committed and that is capable in a variety of ways of acting on their commitments for a thriving Jewish future. Now, maybe it's not 5,000, maybe it's 7,000, maybe it's 4,350. I don't know precisely the number, but I hope that if you're reading Sapir, you're reading Sapir with a view while asking yourself, well, what can I actually do? Not simply to inform myself, but to change things. Because I am, as a reader, concerned about the Jewish future. I'm concerned about anti-Semitism. I'm concerned about continuity. I'm concerned about the relationship between Israel and the diaspora. I'm concerned about clear and present dangers to Israel's very existence. And if you're that kind of reader, then we're trying to create a publication that will spark thinking and hopefully spark action. So that's what we're doing. But we're also, I should add, what we're doing tonight specifically is talking about, I think, one of the very best essays that we've published.
Though I have to say, I'm a little nervous because I'm imagining like a Sapir meeting and saying, who's someone we really disagree with? And he said, that guy Cosgrove. Let's have him submit an article.
No, it doesn't work that way. We think, who's capable of thinking and writing? Thinking well and writing well. And it's not an unlimited number of people. In fact, it's hard to find people who are able to marry deep thinking with clear prose. And you made our lives as editors pretty easy with your essay. So I actually want to turn this conversation a little bit around and talk to you. And by the way, if any of you object to what Elliot says in the course of the conversation, there's no need to come up and slap him. you can just register your objection, even if he says something provoking, you know, take it online or something. But the piece he wrote is called Continuity Requires Religion. And in in a fairly measured way, this essay amounts to what I think is a pretty powerful critique of the way in which Jewishness is done in much of the United States today, which is that we have a kind of an a la carte Jewishness. If you want to express yourself Jewishly by committing to a civic organization, you can do that. If you want to march in a pro-Israel rally, you can do that. But in this menu, religion is just one option among many. And you're making an argument that that isn't really going to fly if you're deeply concerned about Jewish continuity in the long term. Not that any of these other things is wrong or unimportant, but it's just not as central as religion has to be in Jewish identity in order for us to have a thriving Jewish future.
Right. Thank you, and thank you for your graciousness. I certainly now know that not just my mother read the article, but you read the article too. But it is true that there is a critique. The theme of the issue is Jewish continuity. And I begin by saying, as important as the organizations of what I'll call civic religion are, JDC, the Jewish Agency, UJA, ADL, we can go on and on with the alphabet soup of Jewish life, many of which I sit on the boards of and proudly contribute time, talent, treasure as best I can to these organizations are critically important. So it's not an either or, it's a both and with a clear bias towards religious institutions. For me, if the bumper sticker would say it's religion stupid, right? That is, I'm a shul Jew. There's something in someone, in some way, theology is a recapitulation of biography. All of us have an Ur story, right? Something that makes our Jewish hearts tick. And for me, I would say it's the Shabbos table I grew up in. It's knowing that the volunteer hours that my parents committed were always to the synagogue. Where Jewish identity is activated is in the performance of a mitzvah, a performance of a commandment. Now, that is theologically meaningful to me. I believe, as Heschel once wrote, that it's in the performance of a mitzvah where the heaven and the earth kiss, right? There's something happening at that moment when I understand myself responding to God's will. That language works for me. I know it doesn't work for everyone. But that engine of Jewish life, all those organizations, I believe are situated on a Jewish identity that's based in religion, not in civic religion. And if we lose that, then the entire edifice of all the other organizations will collapse. So the article, and we can get into some of the particulars, is a call to action. It's not either or, it's both and. It's an expression that not just the Orthodox world, but the non-Orthodox worlds need to reclaim our commitment to mitzvot as positive acts of Jewish identification, that is the glue that has kept us, that keeps us, and will keep us together as a people through the generations.
So let me ask you about that, and I draw on an analogy with the world of media, which is that if you ask, I think, most people in my profession, you know, why are we seeing long-term declines in readership, in interest in the news, in the robustness, financial robustness of the profession. You will hear from people in the media, you'll say, well, it's been difficult because of the change in the advertising model, and the internet had a devastating effect. and people aren't interested in objective news. I mean, they'll give you a long list of things. Now, if you were to ask me the same question, I would say, well, because we're putting out a by and large mediocre product that is less and less interesting to read, that is more obsessed with its own inner, that has a set of values that are very different from those of our presumptive readership, that is solipsistic in the extreme, and we never hold up a mirror to ourselves as an institution, as a profession, while we're trying to hold up a mirror to everyone else. So, is that analysis? Can you make that analysis about what's happened to for Jews, for shul going Jewry? What exactly has gone wrong that so many Jews now call themselves Jews of no religion? Is it simply grand forces at work, or should we talk about what's happening in shuls or what's not happening here?
I think there's a lot going on. I don't think it's any one thing. I think it's multiple forces all happening. And I appreciate your question. I think we need great Jewish educators. We need great rabbis. We need strong communities making passion-filled arguments for Jewish life. And if we don't, people vote with their feet and we have only ourselves to blame. So I recognize that point. I am a believer, right? I do believe that if we had those structures in place, the product, if you will, not journalism, but Judaism, sells. I think that, it's hard, right? I think that there is a marketplace, right, for the secular Jew who's deciding whether or not to go to SoulCycle, a yoga studio, or shul on a Shabbat morning. There are a series of choices, and you have to live intentionally and prioritize your Jewish identity over a series of other choices that are also compelling in the choices that we face. I think that there are impediments, hurdles of knowledge. I think it, and this is in the prescriptive part of the article, but I think that we have people with degrees and levels of sophistication that are in secular culture that our ancestors couldn't imagine possible, but the ability to open up a prayer book, find your page, recite Kiddush, perform the basic acts of observance are foreign to them. And so it's much easier, right? So there's an element of fear, of admitting to ignorance, as well as, it's easier, and this is going to come out the wrong way, but I'll say it anyway. It's easier to write a check. It's easier to sign up for a conference. It's easier to call someone else self-hating Jew or to criticize Israel than it is to actually sit down and learn how to say Kiddush at your Friday night table. So I'm always struck by what aspect of this of American Jewish identity is a sort of compensatory act for a paper thin knowledge of the rituals of Jewish life and living. I remember I was once reading Herzl's diaries, and at the Basel conference, he describes his fear not. He was a secular Jew, obviously. His biggest fear was not about standing in front of the conference and setting in motion this nascent Zionist movement. His biggest fear was he knew that as a convener of the conference, he was going to be called to synagogue that Shabbos morning and say the bracha before the Torah, and he didn't know the bracha before the Torah. Right? That same story could be told about many Jews today. Right? They are movers and shakers, industry titans, but the basic ABCs are not there.
What is missing in terms of communicating the value of leading a more Jewish life? How is that not being translated to more Jews, that this is something that ought to be a larger part of their lives?
Well, I think it comes with education. I think it comes with inspiration. I think it comes with community building and mentorship. And I think that it comes with adapting back to your journalism analogy of the Jewish community willing to pivot out of received models to new models. Americans adapt all sorts of behaviors with Fitbits, with TikToks, with, from what's it, from your couch to your Peloton, whatever it might be. We have no problem with adaptive behaviors. We just haven't yet applied that technology, if you will, to our Jewish lives. I think the technology is there. I think the mitzvot are there, but we haven't put the two together.
Yuval Levin, who you must know and is a real, just a thoughtful student of public policy, but also religion, wrote an interesting essay in defense of hard pews, which is to say that maybe the religions that are succeeding in America, I mean, succeeding in terms of not their inner truths, but in terms of creating exciting community, are the ones that are moving in the opposite direction, not more TikTok, not 1,000 easier ways to have access to some Jewish learning, but something quite different to say this is a religion that is not going to be soft. It's not going to be easy. In fact, it's hard, and the payoff is a sense of pride in participating in this. And the metaphor is the hard pew. And I wonder if perhaps the problem is the opposite of what many people think. It isn't that Judaism or Jewish life isn't accessible enough, right? It's that we haven't said, well, yeah, it's tough. And it's not always comfortable, and you will be told things that you don't like because Judaism is a tradition that challenges your thinking, doesn't simply adapt itself to whatever you happen to think is right. And maybe that's a more, for the longer term, a better model for kind of thriving Jewish life.
Well, first of all, let me tell you that everyone in this room will agree that our pews are deeply uncomfortable. But let me make a distinction.
And unchanged since...
Unchanged since this building was built. Yeah. God bless tradition. So I'm not suggesting, it's actually quite the opposite, that the particularism, the hard pews of Judaism, that argument has run their course. I haven't read this piece, but I think I understand the gist of it, meaning... My proposition, you know, as a rabbi, is that, yes, there are certain things on the menu that you don't order. And there is one day of the week that is substantively different than the rest of the days of your week. And yes, there are people you marry and there are people you don't marry. And unapologetically so, that religion is a series of decisions and there are do's and there are don'ts. And that's what it means to lead a committed Jewish life. That's and frankly, I think that has traction and resonance. That has not run its course. I don't think tribalism has run its course. I don't think ritual has run its course. I think that in the beating heart of every Jew and would-be Jew and secular Jew, and frankly, every person, there are certain existential questions that we put our heads to our pillow at night and wonder, what does it mean to define a good life? How am I connected to a tradition that preceded me and extends beyond me? These questions, and for me, Judaism is the best toolbox around the rituals of Judaism to ask and to grapple and to answer those questions. What I do think when I was saying about the technology, and here, and take this for what you will. I have ripped a page out of the Chabad playbook, in the sense that the Judaism that they understood American Jewry better than anyone else, in the sense that the Judaism that we teach and preach can't come with guilt. It can't come with finger wagging. It's not about how you are missing the bar, but it's rather meeting where you are and setting a bar of aspiration to which you can aspire. I have deep problems with much of Chabad, but I'm saying, but that is what I think the prescriptive move for American Jewry has to be. And we will create the tools and the demeanor by which you can go up the on-ramp to Jewish life and living. And so Judaism is hard. It's advanced citizenship. But I think we need to meet Jews where they are and inspire them to go to where I believe everyone aspires to be.
So I once, a rabbi who, a friend of mine who shall remain nameless, he's probably watching this, he once asked me for a recommendation. He was applying for, a PhD program. And so I said, sure. And so I wrote a recommendation, and what I thought was being nice, I sent the recommendation, and then I sent him a copy of all the nice things I said about him. And one of the things I said was, you know, Rabbi so-and-so is just about one of the most brilliant rabbis I've ever met. And he said, what are you trying to insult me? Because, sorry, I guess the joke fell flat. The way he saw it is, oh, I'm an intelligent rabbi, like as if the bar, had been set lower. And I thought, no, I meant it as a sincere compliment. But clearly, do we have the rabbinate we need to energize congregations and create the kind of thriving Jewish life we want? And if we don't, what needs to be done? To ask
all right,
Lennon's question.
Yeah, no, it is Thursday night, and I have a sermon to write, but I think this is what I'm going to talk about on Shabbos. So,
sorry.
No, but still come or live stream. And the night is yet young, and the conversation, we still have a road to travel, so I could change my mind. But there's a crisis going on right now, and you can follow this in the pages of the Jewish press and the foreword or otherwise. I was speaking to a few people. Prior, there is a crisis going on in the development of Jewish leadership, and you know we can hang our hat on the rabbinate itself, and that has to do with creating a vibrant pipeline of educators who will lead communities that will therefore produce a certain subset of committed Jews who one day will be crazy enough and inspired enough to become Jewish educators. And some of those Jewish educators will become rabbis to lead the communities. And the crisis is, and you can look at the numbers, the number of people applying to rabbinical school, the number of people graduating from rabbinical school, the number of communities who are not being served by rabbis right now. There are, you know, systemic structural problems in remuneration and retention. We've taken a beating. A lot of rabbis are taking early retirement right now because we've all had such a rough few years, but anyone who's in the business, whether it's a classroom teacher or a rabbi, things of public assembly, we are spending our days asking questions that none of us are qualified to answer, and none of us went into the rabbinate to spend our days dealing with. Just so everyone knows, the story of Park Avenue Synagogue is in a bubble based on what I understand is going on in American Jewry. So if we want to take our charge seriously as a flagship community, it's not just thank you for supporting the synagogue. Thank you for buying a gala journal ad this year. That said, I want everyone to know that if you really care about American Jewry, then you should care about Jewish education. You should care about paying teachers and other rabbis, a wage that when someone is coming out of college and deciding whether or not to go to medical school, business school, or law school, rabbinical school is right there for the best and the brightest. It's not the case right now, and I got a lot more to say about this. I'll say it on Shabbos morning.
Let me ask you just in connection to that. My standard joke is that I grew up as minimally Jewish as you can be without being a Unitarian.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that, but tell your joke.
Well, that was the joke.
Okay. So I'm 0 for 2. We might have a Will Smith moment. But what is your war story, Brett? I mean, what is, how I think there's, you grew up in Mexico?
Mexico City.
So, right, I was thinking about that. How did that shape, if our Jewishness is somehow a recapitulation of our biography, if
so,
I may?
So I grew up with a mother who was a Jewish child in Nazi-occupied Europe, and a father whose father had changed his name to Stevens in search of the most anodyne Anglo-American name possible as a way out of it had been Ehrlich, and he wanted really not a lot to do with his Jewish roots, spoke fluent Yiddish, came from a religious, you know, background way back when, but was moving out. And there are two moments in my personal biography that I think were decisive. When I was a sophomore in college, I signed up for a seminar at the University of Chicago on Genesis with a man named Leon Cass. And Leon, whom I just saw today, was the wisest and sharpest man I have ever met in my whole life. And in reading Genesis, not as a religious text, but in an intellectual endeavor at a great university, it opened my mind to the intellectual depth and majesty of this book, in that I had a sophomoric idea that religion was fairy tales and noble lies for the benefit of making people reasonably moral. And then the encounter with Genesis in the hands of a masterly teacher like Leon made it impossible to think that. It forced me into a recognition that my Jewish heritage had intellectual riches that I had never previously suspected. So that was one part of the story. And the second part of the story is connected to my name, Stevens, which is that just after 9/11, I was in Israel on 9/11 as it happened, but I was living in Brussels and kind of hanging out with the Brussels Euro elite, that centers around the European Union. And after 9/11, there was a tremendous amount of chatter among people in my social circle that this wouldn't be happening if it weren't for Israel. A terrorist attack killing thousands of Americans perpetrated quite openly by a radical Islamist in Afghanistan, and really was all the fault of Israel and the Jews. And I heard this again and again. And I heard it because, as a friend of mine likes to say, I have a goyishy face and a goyishy name, and no one suspected that I was Jewish. And so the name that my grandfather had adopted in the 1920s to try to work his way out of his Jewish roots became, in a way, the vessel through which I started to, or once again, re-entered that Jewish stream. And it was not long after that that the Jerusalem Post came to me with a job offer. And I said, that Israel's the country where I want to be. This is the story that I want to cover. This is what matters to me. And it's, by the way, it's the same story with Sapir, because, I love covering foreign policy. I love covering the world of politics. But as I said at the beginning, I felt intellectually that there was just an open field in issues that I cared deeply about, and I wanted a hand in shaping these sorts of conversations, not just coming to this synagogue to talk about Ukraine, although I'm sure maybe we're going to talk about that or some other foreign issue, but to really think deeply about how we turn the Jewish story in the best possible direction.
So if you were, thank you. Well, I've never asked you that question. So this intellectual richness your awareness of right this moment when you were passing as a non-Jew, if you will. And so we're party to these conversations. So I've defined the road ahead as mitzvot,
yeah,
as positive Jewish acts of identification. Is it possible that either be it the fear of the other, vigilance on behalf of Israel, or this, or a positive category of intellectual riches, does that have shelf life in your mind? I mean, what would your prescriptive recommendations be? I actually have absolutely no idea what your personal observance is and what your home life is about, but how would you recommend that if we care about this thing called Judaism, it's passed down from generation to generation?
So for the longest time, I resisted the argument that you made in your piece that a Jewish identity without Jewish content, and by that I don't mean, you know, Woody Allen films, although I'm going to say this, I love Woody Allen films. Now someone's going to punch me. For the longest time, I thought, well, you could have it because, of course, Jewishness is a whole set of identities and affinities, none of which necessarily need to involve the religious side of life. As I've gotten older, I have reluctantly, and I say reluctantly because I'm kind of kicking and screaming getting to this place.
I'll meet you where you are, Brett.
Reluctantly coming to the conclusion that it's untenable. And it's untenable in personal life because as you get older, you are dealt with a series of events in life that take you to larger questions that don't have sort of TikTok answers. And untenable in a larger way because of what I encountered with Leon Kass, that ultimately Judaism is a civilization, and it's a civilization that rests on a set of beliefs which have a powerful claim to being true. And you cannot be fully Jewish unless you at least are prepared to deeply examine the nature of those convictions and the possibility of their truth. And this, again, as I said, you know, this is another Chabad rabbi, Zosa. I want to learn with you. And I keep putting him off, you know, by several years. But I know it's coming, right, in the way that I know that I'm going to eventually have to get around to reading War and Peace before I kick the bucket. Because I think that it's unavoidable. I wish, however, in hindsight, that I had been exposed to this at a much earlier age. I wish that I hadn't kind of come to it in such a serendipitous way.
So it's not therapy, but what do you think? I mean, why are we failing young people so? meaning, why is it that, everyone has the Hebrew school they hated, and it's not taken seriously. And your story actually mirrors my own. It was actually an intro to Bible class that really sparked my intellectual journey, very much like yours. Yet we're not doing it at a younger age.
Well, so here's another analogy from the world of media. One of the reasons in which I think we've had these declines in media is that the trend over the last 40 or 50 years of the news media was to make itself more accessible by making it easier, bigger pictures, infographics, news you can use, all this. Basically, I'm going to insult someone again, the USA Today-ification of the media. And by diminishing the quality of authority that someone like Walter Cronkite had. You know, why was there so much trust in media when one white guy with a mustache, you know, would say, and that's the way it is, right? Because he had a gravelly voice, and immense effort was put into transforming Walter Cronkite into a figure of unassailable authority. So media had authority without representativeness. We've tried to make the media a lot more democratic. We've tried to bat to many more fields. And there's an argument, you know, there are valid arguments to be made for that. But what I think we've done, and I'm speaking in a general way, is we've diminished the quality of authority that media needed in order to be trusted. We diminished it by violating trust. We diminished it by being stupid, by getting stories wrong. The main thing I would say, though, is if you want to get the best and the brightest, right, I think you need a kind of a trickle-down theory, which is it ought to be hard and it ought to be challenging and it ought to be pitched at the highest intellectual level possible. You know, why did people, I used to work for many years at the Wall Street Journal. Why did you read the Wall Street Journal? Because your boss read the Wall Street Journal or your dad read the Wall Street Journal, and it was what important people read, right? And that was actually what the journal's very kind of forbidding qualities, especially in the old days when it was just, you know, text and those little graphic photos, were actually, I think, its chief selling point. It was hard to access. You had to understand things. And, you know, why was it only at the University of Chicago that I began to understand, oh, there's something here for me, right? Because it was pitched at a very high level. I think we dumb things down far too much, and it ends up being like, I'm eating my vegetables, they taste bad, and for what, right? And for what? So how do you offer bright Jewish youngsters that for what? And I don't think it can just simply because this is a good, you know, it'll turn you into a slightly better person, or because your grandparents expect it and you'll get lots of presents and you'll get a huge bar mitzvah party. But the effort should be steered towards the very brightest young Jews. This is something that it has mysteries in here for them to unpack, discover, reveal, and share.
It's a beautiful vision. So let me pivot for a second, because there are a few questions that were submitted. There are questions we're going to open it up for discussion in right after this question. So think about what your question might be. But in this issue on Jewish continuity, in this the issue of Jewish continuity, I want to talk about Israel for a second, because what had once been the very thing that brought us together as a diaspora Jewish community has become a point of division, divisiveness. And I'm just wondering, when the story is told about the ups and downs of American Jewry, how does the Israel conversation fit in your mind?
So I'd like to think, and maybe you're going to push back, and I think it's a valid debate to have, I'd like to think that the story of Israel as a source of Jewish division is vastly exaggerated. And by that, I don't mean that we have honorable differences of opinion as to whether Israel should do X or Y. Those are normal conversations that any community has about what's the right way forward with an agreed goal that we should want an Israel to thrive and maintain its Jewish and democratic character for generations. I'm talking about the idea that there's an increasing segment of the Jewish community that just wants no part of Israel, thinks it's an apartheid state and all the rest of it. I think these voices are very loud, very prominent on social media, very canny in getting themselves in people's faces, but I don't think it's particularly representative. That being said, I would love to have more Jews, especially Jews who are not by any means anti-Israel, but are just essentially not committed, not interested, for them to more deeply understand that without Israel, there's probably no Jewish future. And to the extent that they value a Jewish future, it's something they should consider. Without Israel, the ability for Jewish civilization not only to regenerate, but to reinvent itself isn't there. And without Israel, when they come for you, you'll have nowhere to go. And if secular Jews who are now looking at Pittsburgh and Poway and Colleyville are getting the message that something is deeply scary in the world, and something, and that they are not going to be easily immune from what's happened in Europe and so many other places, that thought also should animate them about the value of a Jewish state. My colleague Mark Charendoff wrote an essay for the forthcoming issue of Sapir, quoting a line from Robert Frost, that home is the place where when you have to go somewhere, they have to take you in. And we can't be sure that America is always going to be that place.
Look, it's a powerful argument. I don't know if I have pushback or on it. I feel it very viscerally, as my community knows. I was just in Poland and actually was party to some of the Jewish agency's efforts to resettle Ukrainian refugees, Jewish refugees in Israel. So that narrative of, and actually at our Birkat HaMazon, in our table, I actually stopped it in the middle because there's Harachaman Hu Yavarech, you know, Kol HaNetunim Betzara, all those who are given over in sorrow. And for a while, I was like, you know what, we're fine. You know, Syrian Jewry's fine. The Iranian Jews got out. Like, okay, maybe something's going on in Venezuela, but like, Jews are fine. And then I actually saw it with my own eyes. And I sort of said, thank God for Israel, in a way that I had never felt in my life, helping, you know, that happened.
But the point is, I
think what I felt that day, I don't think that's shared. I think the issue of Pittsburgh and Poway and Charlottesville or wherever it might be, I don't think that argument for Israel has resonance in a vast segment. And the idea that without Israel, Judaism would not exist, I think that maybe not here at Park Avenue, but in other places, you just get a lot of blank stares.
Let me ask you this. Am I underestimating the extent to which among especially younger Jews, Israel or Zionism has become simply toxic? Am I just not paying attention?
I'm with you. I'm not worried about toxicity. I'm worried about apathy. I think that the problem is that it's just hard. What? It's over there. They don't like us anyway. We're, you know, one too many news stories. And I think COVID has done a number on this relationship. It's accelerated that trend where the topic of Israel has just become sort of another topic as opposed to sort of core to the Jewish experience. I feel it in our community, right? We have, I'm proud to say, we have more members of our congregation going to Israel back and forth. I would put our numbers up against any synagogue in North America, and it's been totally flat for obvious reasons the last 2 years. You feel it. You know, you count the number of Israel sermons that have been given, right? The numbers are down. Right, there's a change. I'm sorry.
Well, I
do want to leave. So, 10 minutes for questions.
Okay, I guess the last question I have for you in that connection is, you know, I think part of the problem we have in terms of our Israel conversations is that, and I in a way am just as guilty of it, with my last answer, is they have two forms. One is Israel's in lots of danger. Right? Iran, Hezbollah, Gaza, et cetera, BDS. You got to come in and rescue it. And by the way, you want to rescue it because if, God forbid, everything else should go wrong, then it'll be the place you're going to want to go. And by the way, did we mention it's in a lot of danger and surrounded by lots of enemies? Maybe that makes sense of why the conversation is so difficult to have. Mm-hmm. But it seems like the unexpressed conversation is the one that I think can arguably be made more with more conviction now, which is Israel's actually a terrific place. It's no longer the place where large fortunes go to become small fortunes. It's no longer the place where you're going to have to basically give up your life for the sake of an ideal that hopefully your kids will be able to make good on. But it's a terrific country where everyone has a sense of purpose and agency and belonging that doesn't necessarily exist anywhere else, even when they're not Ukrainians being shelled by Russians or the French worried about murders and anti-Semitic violence. That it's the attractive side of the destination. That it's an identity. It's a nation that affirms an identity that is a profoundly good and enriching place to be. And maybe that's what's missing in terms of this conversation. That you should want to go to Israel, in a sense, for the same reason that you want to go to some, I shouldn't say this, to Florida, right? Because life is just a little freer and more interesting there. I just got into lots of trouble.
No, but you just also put your finger on it. Meaning, so what is the, in I'm not talking about meaning, right? I think some of it has to do with, you know, my family story. Some of it has to do with my age. Some of it has to do with just the way I'm wired. I agree with every single thing you just said. Just now, not earlier things. But when it comes to Israel. But I think the question of why a secular, you know, Jew of no religion feels any closer to everything you just described to the Jewish community in Israel as opposed to the Jewish community of Florida is not self-evident. It's not self-evident. And I think that's deserving of a fuller conversation. Let's get some questions. So let's take some hands and yes, please. Let's give it a second for a microphone. A question involves a short statement with a question mark at the end.
You thought I'd need to be reminded of that, huh? Earlier in the conversation, I heard a binary, meaning the ritually observant Jew versus the civil religion Jew. But what about the Jew who is not ritually observant, but has studied Judaism, has a deep intellectual understanding of it, has a visceral passion for Israel, and in a very mindful, intentional way, lives his life according to Jewish values or her life.
So I'm a rabbi. I surround myself in a synagogue. My bets are on ritual life. I don't believe. And this is so like YouTubeable, and someone's going to clip this and say it, but I don't believe that all those other things of civic religion are passed down to an APAC membership does not pass down from generation to generation, right? The memory of one generation lighting Shabbos candles, knowing the bracha that you say that is passed down at your children's, right? I see it time and time again. It is the ritual observances, the mitzvot of Jewish life and living that are the, I talk about the Proustian Madeleine, whether it's memory, whether it's theology, whether it's differentiating yourself from a community of living intentionally saying, yeah, my Friday night, I'm not going to the theater. I'm inviting friends for Shabbos dinner. Right? These differentiate ourselves as a people, and I believe are the best bet to, it's not that the other stuff's not important, it is, but it only happens by way of the rituals of Jewish life and living. I'm sticking with it.
Hi, I'm asking this in full view of the plaque that says Arthur Oakes over there. I assume he had something to do with the New York Times. But my question is, what latitude do you have, Brett, to call out a bad headline or an anti-Israel story in the newsroom? Because quite frankly, you know, were it not for your column and Will Schwartz's crossword puzzle, I would have canceled my New York Times a long time ago, as my father of blessed memory did. Because, you know, frankly, it's anti-Israel to...
All right, I think we got it. I am cutting you off, but we got it. Yes.
Yeah, I have full latitude to write what I want. And that has, on more than one occasion, led to my open criticism of decisions by the paper in the paper, which I don't think I could have gotten away with at other publications, by the way. And I think that's a pretty ringing commitment by the Times to not only have probably the most pro-Israel writer there is featured prominently in their pages, but to let him say what he wants to say, even if it doesn't always sit comfortably with other voices at the Times. I mean, you'll be amazed. I've never heard your question before. So I have to think.
He has the same four questions in a few weeks anyway.
That's true. You know, when I was at the Wall Street Journal, I used to think that the Times and the Journal were sort of equivalent papers in terms of their reach and their influence. And it turns out that's not true. The Journal is like the Grateful Dead. If you're into it, you're into it. But if you're not, you barely think of it, right? And the Times is like the Beatles. Everyone participates. And so even if I'm Ringo, I'm with the band. And the reach of the paper, I've been there now, I'm coming on my fifth anniversary at the paper. The reach of the paper just astonishes me, amazes me, impresses me. It has a long tradition of having voices like mine, whether it was Abe Rosenthal, or Bill Sapphire. And the opportunity, and I'll say the privilege of being able to reach now 10 million readers, potential readers, every time I write a column is not one I want to pass up. And I also would add, I know people love to criticize the Times, and the Times publishes the equivalent of Shakespeare's entire oeuvre every week in terms of word count. So there are plenty of mistakes that get made, plenty to criticize if you're publishing that much. But there's some astonishingly good journalism in the Times, and no more. I can't think of a better moment now than our coverage of Ukraine, where we are just covering the story in the way that no other publication even comes close. And the ability of the paper to throw brilliant reporters and talent and resources into reporting that it deserves to be noted even among the criticism. It's amazing.
So a rapid last question for you, and you mentioned Ukraine. So Russia's invasion of Ukraine is not a Jewish issue, but it is a Jewish issue. So in your mind, in this synagogue, as a Jew, how does what's going on in Ukraine affect you? Why is it a Jewish issue?
Well, obviously, the particulars are obvious to everyone. There are Ukrainian Jewish refugees now desperate for resettlement. Beyond the Jewish refugees, there are refugees, and we have moral obligations towards them as well. And our experience as refugees makes those obligations, I think, that much keener and more deeply felt. But a point I've made for a long time is that the best foreign policy is one in which values shape interests rather than interests shaping values. And the best example of that is Harry Truman's decision to recognize the State of Israel. If he had gone with the advice of George Marshall and James Forrestal, the Secretary of Defense, It would have been an interest-driven decision where all the interests seemed to argue against recognizing Israel. The Arabs had the oil. The Arabs were probably going to win, right? And the Arab world was a zone of contest with the Soviet Union in the early days of the Cold War. And Truman decided on a course that had very little by way of immediate interest being served, but values being served, that the Jewish people deserved to be recognized in an independent nation state. And that the suffering of the Jewish people, as well as what they had accomplished in the Yishuv, deserved American recognition. And it turned out to be one of the best foreign policy decisions the United States ever made. Because we know that there's not going to be a coup next week in Israel where suddenly an anti-American government is going to come in and threaten to use nuclear weapons or attack its neighbors. We did the right thing. Morally, and it turned out to be the right thing from a value from an interest standpoint as well. And I see a parallel here with Ukraine. And I know, especially when it comes to Israel's position vis-a-vis Ukraine, there's a lot of talk that Israel has a set of complex interests, and Russia's in Syria, not to mention the negotiations over the Iranian nuclear deal, and that Israel should therefore tread cautiously. But I think it's unfortunate, to say the least, that this Israeli government hasn't been vastly more outspoken in saying that just as we, Israel, is an embattled democracy facing a tyrannical and malevolent and evil foe, so are our Ukrainian brothers and sisters. And the state of Israel should stand in a clear way with President Zelensky and his government and Ukrainians fighting against oppression and tyranny. Their story is ours, and we should say that loud and clear.
Okay. Brett, thank you. To Sapir, to Mark, to Ariella, to Felicia, to Rabbi Kaufman, to Julie, to Mara, thank you to everyone here, and we look forward to this and relationship.
And to this guy.
And most of all, Brett, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Have a good night.